just want to say that what we're going to be talking about today, this is a fairly preliminary and descriptive look, analysis of newly added sexual identity and sexual behavior questions to a regional, from a regional population-based survey. There's a bit on gender identity as well at the end. I'd love to be able to talk more about it, but we will in the future. In some ways, this is a kind of case study, a different kind of case study, but also very relevant, of the movement towards including sexual orientation data in population surveys. So it fits very nicely with what we've been talking about. We also attempted to touch on larger issues that are beyond just our own region, related to this larger conversation about advocacy for the health and well-being of LGBT populations. So that's what we're looking at. In brief, the issues that we're going to be looking at following from that, looking at this LGBT population that we've just gathered data on, and talking about how the self-identified LGB population overlaps and remains distinct from those who report same-gender behaviors. And that's a key component of this today. It's one of the things I want to be able to focus on. And then how do we begin to think about adding valid gender identity questions to population surveys? Background, this is all probably quite familiar to everybody here, so I will just very briefly, we know that previous population-based research on sexual minority populations has identified important health disparities, demonstrated that sexual behavior is not a predictor of sexual identity and vice versa, and that both are necessary to assess health and well-being, and has been crucial in motivating and supporting advocacy for equal access to and improved quality of care for LGBT folks. We also know that the integration and normalization of sexual identity questions is underway, as Randy has explained and been involved in for so long. And it's also worth noting, though, that sexual identity and partner gender questions are still pretty uncommon on surveys that are not specifically targeting sexual behavior or risk, particularly HIV risk. So adding it to these general population surveys is crucial, and it's pretty special that we were able to, and in Philadelphia. So this survey, these data come from the 2006 Southeastern Pennsylvania Household Health Survey. This is a cross-sectional RDD telephone survey of just over 10,000 adults, 18 and over, in the region. It covers a whole range of topics related to health status, health behaviors, access to care. And this particular survey was fielded in the summer of 2006. And we, the survey, just to give you a little sense, it's intended to provide regional agencies and institutions with a uniquely rich and very locally specific data source to guide program planning, funding, development, and so on. So that's the context of the survey. We also have sample weights based on U.S. Census 2006 projections that were used to match Southeastern Pennsylvania's age, race, gender, and income profile. The key measures of interest today, the central measures, first, self-reported sexual identity. The question that was asked was similar to those that have been asked on other national surveys. There were some unintended differences we can talk about at the end if you're interested, but the key, we were happy to see that our LGB prevalence estimates were pretty comparable to other national estimates, so we feel very confident that these data are pretty useful and relevant. The second measure elicits gender of sexual partners. In the past year, have your sexual partners been male, female, or both? With an additional category for those who have had no sexual partners in the previous year. And now, an initial look at the frequencies of these core measures. First, self-reported sexual identity. We found about just about 2% of the survey population were LGB identified, about 200 respondents. 97% heterosexually identified, under half a percent responded they were something else, and just about 1% declined to answer. And these are, again, pretty comparable to other national estimates, which usually find about 2 to 5% of the general population identifying as LGB. What I'm going to be focusing on in the bivariate analyses that come is a comparison between the LGB identified and the heterosexually identified folks. Second measure, gender of sexual partners, notably about 2.5%, so a few more folks identified, reported that they'd had same gender or male and female sexual partners in the previous year. So you see that there's a discrepancy there, and that's part of what we're talking about. About 78% reported different gender partners, 17% no sex partners, and about 2% declined. All right. Oh, and this, again, we're going to be focusing on comparing those with same gender or both gender partners to those with different gender partners. And you'll note that we're talking about fairly broad groups here, and this is partially a sample size issue, certainly. We did break down the LGB folks by gender and by bisexuality to take a look, but for the subsequent bivariate analyses, we grouped everybody together to look to sort of consider the larger experiences of sexual minorities in the area. But in terms of the LGB folks, just so you know, about 55% were men, about 45% were women, and about a third overall were bisexually identified as opposed to lesbian or gay identified. All right. We did three sets of bivariate analyses looking at sort of from three different directions at these issues. The first looks at the identity question. Are you LGB identified? And we compared those who are LGB identified to those who are heterosexually identified to look for demographic differences in these populations to begin to get a sense. Certainly in our region, it's important because we don't have much of a sense yet of what's going on in general with LGB populations in the region, and to begin to talk about variation within populations. So some demographic differences and findings of no differences. We found no differences by gender, by race, ethnicity, or by income. So similar distributions there. We did find significant differences by age group, by marital or partner status, education level, employment status, and city versus suburbs, so area of residence. And this is a little bit of a tease. I don't have time to go through each of these. If you do have questions about any of these particular differences, you can ask me later. I can mail you more slides. I've got more. But just two examples of this peak. Looking at age group, it's notable right away that our LGB population is heavily weighted towards the younger age group. Over half are in the 18 to 39 age category, so we're seeing a young population there. Also looking at the oldest category, only 12% of those who are LGB identified were 60 plus, as compared to about a quarter of those who are heterosexually identified. Possible interesting discussions we could have might relate to, is there a generational effect going on here? Is it related to comfort with talking about the identity labels or with these issues in general, on the telephone in particular? There may be a regional effect as well. Secondly, area of residence, comparing city versus suburbs, very broad look. As we might expect, we see that those who are LGB identified are more likely to live in the city, in Philadelphia, but also very notable, over half of the LGB folks live in the suburban counties, which fits nicely with a lot of the findings that are coming out now from the census data looking at same-sex couples, and that find that LGB folks are now identifiably located beyond just urban centers, which was the initial sort of common wisdom about, well, where do gay people live in cities? And actually we see an interesting distribution there. And this is obviously just a very broad look. We could geocode this and probably find a lot of other interesting things. Second, behavior-based measure and bivariate analysis. No differences, again, by gender, race, ethnicity, education this time. Differences, again, by age, income this time, partner status, employment status, and city versus suburbs. Again, two quick examples. Age group, again, similar finding. We wanted to see if the same age trend held. Some variation here, but you do see that about 55% of those who had same gender or both gender partners were in the 18 to 39 category, in that younger age group. Income level. One notable thing here is that you'll see that those with same gender, both gender partners are much less likely to be in the highest income bracket and are more likely to be in that lowest income bracket. So it looks like there's some pretty interesting economic variation here between these populations. Now, the third set of bivariate analyses, we wanted to take a look at that overlap and non-overlap between these kinds of measures in these populations. So we looked at those who were LGB identified and had same gender behaviors in some fashion, and those who were non-LGB identified with same gender partners. So taking a look at that, just so that you know about what the numbers are here, there were 170 LGB identified folks with same gender partners, so who had kind of an overlap there, and 78 who were non-LGB identified and had same gender partners. And we found no differences between these two groups based on gender, marital or partner status, and area of residence. We did find differences by age group, income, education level, employment status, and race ethnicity. I'm going to skip through these two examples now because I'm running out of time, but I want to show you we wanted to do an initial multivariate analysis. There's more to do here, but we wanted to look at some possible predictors of having same-gender partners with no LGB identity. So these are the results of the logistic regression that we did. We threw gender in to see whether it might emerge, and we wanted to just make sure to control for it there. What we found is that age has an independent effect here, clearly, and it's in fact the strongest independent effect. Those who are in the oldest age category are about 8.5 times more likely to have same-gender partners and no LGB identity. Education also had some independent effects when controlling for gender, age, race, and those with more education were less likely to have no LGB identity in conjunction with same-gender partners, so were less likely to be non-overlapping. And in terms of race, there was a smaller effect. Those who are Black or African American were about 2.5 times more likely to have no LGB identity along with having same-gender partners as compared to the white population. And there was no effect there for Latinos as compared to the white population. All right, last component. I want to talk a little bit about making gender explicit on population surveys, in particular on phone surveys. I'm not sure how many people here work on phone surveys, but it's one thing that you may or may not be familiar with. Much survey research doesn't actually include any explicit question about gender. Instead, gender is inferred based on voice or other cues in most phone surveys, at least. This does not obviously apply to other survey research. And we believe that an important part of accurate data collection in relation to sexual minorities and in relation to the general population will be to begin to make gender explicit on surveys. So following from that, we actually added two gender-related questions to the 2006 survey. First, we asked, what was your sex at birth, male, female, or other? And we also asked a question about current gender, man, woman, transgender, or other. And what we found, you may not be surprised to know, given that it's a phone survey, is that our sample population did not represent the gender diversity that we know from other research exists in our population. But we compared those two different items, and we did find a little bit that might be of interest related to possible gender change, people reporting a change in gender. So about 98% reported no change in gender. 29 folks reported that there had been some change in gender. 5 people identified as transgender or something else. And about 1% refused the questions. And a handful of people also didn't know. So I think probably the most interesting thing actually on this slide is that those who were born male and those who were born female were equally likely to report some kind of change in gender, which is actually counter to a lot of the sort of popular media imagery that is typically very negative, but also focuses primarily on those who are male to female. So that's one thing to start thinking about. There are limitations. Certainly with a phone survey, you can only reach those who can be reached by a phone survey, leaving out a chunk of the population. We did wait to account for households without telephones, but that certainly always remains a limitation of phone surveys. In terms of sample size is always an issue. Even with a 10,000 household survey, the 2% slice gets pretty small. So we weren't able to do these analyses, again, with gender broken out, with bisexuality broken out. Our questions did differ slightly, but again, they were fairly comparable to the overall population prevalences. And the gender identity questions were new and untested, so there's much work to be done there. We don't have anything to compare those two. There is some other work going on, a lot of in other areas, but those ones are sort of their own. This is its own case. And finally, we certainly found a number of demographic differences between some of these different populations of interest. And the real message there is that, as I said at the start, as we move towards the inclusion of sexual identity questions on surveys, as well as sexual behavior questions, we do want to make sure that both are being included. And this is interesting and poses some challenges, given that, as Randy pointed out, every question added ultimately means the question might have to leave or die. So that that's the unhappy side of the story. But we would argue strongly, and as you saw, there's quite a lot of variability, and if you are capturing only one segment of the population, there is quite a bit that's going to be missed, which will have a whole series of implications as we look at health outcomes, as we look at opportunities, and so on. Finally, future directions. Attention certainly needs to be devoted towards the accurate and careful collection of trans-inclusive gender information in order to begin to get a sense of scope and health issues and representative data for this very sort of often hard-to-reach population. That's not going to be easy, and it's not necessarily right now something that phone surveys can take on, though we wanted to try it. But an important starting point, I feel this quite firmly, is making sure that phone surveys include even a basic gender question as part of the survey, so that both the surveyors and respondents become accustomed to identifying gender, which is currently not a standard part. So those are sort of the main points that I wanted to make, and feel free to ask me more later if you have other questions. Thank you very much. There's my contact information, as well as Heather's. Yes. I hadn't thought of that. In this case, they would have had to make quite a leap, because the question was specifically about sexual partners in the past year. But, I mean, there is always room for confusion on any question, so it's certainly possible. But probably in this case, it really is about... There may be other sort of questions of understanding and confusion, but probably... Well, anyway, just to say that the question was, in the past year, have you had male, female, or both male and female sexual partners. So. In terms of other surveys, I'll defer to Randy, but just one note that we did listen in to some of the surveys. I think that's a great point, and it would be a fascinating follow-up study. We actually talk about that a lot on a lot of different questions for the phone survey. Let's research everything that happens and do feedback surveys. There's not funding for that, sadly, yet. But that is very interesting, and we did listen in to some because we were very concerned about whether this was going to be a problem. We put the gender identity questions at the very end of the survey to try to mitigate if there was, the hang-up problem that people fear. There did not seem to be a major hang-up problem. For the most part, people, what we heard were respondents thinking and answering the question. Occasionally, there was some befuddlement, but it would be really interesting to more systematically look into those questions. Right. Absolutely. And in fact, that's a great point, and that's why I would absolutely say the first step is just adding a basic gender question, but simultaneously having a conversation, a gender question that just, you know, man, woman, but having a conversation about how can we make this more complex so we can get some representative data. But I think